O my Lord, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. In your impersonal Brahman effulgence in the spiritual sky, there is no occasional change and no deterioration of internal potency. I surrender unto you because whereas I am proud of my material body and senses, your lordship is the cause of the cosmic manifestation, and yet you are untouched by matter. Report by Srila Prabhupada. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, 1855, Bhaktya mam abhijanati yavan yashchasmi tatvataha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead can only be partially known, and only by the process of devotional service to the Lord. Lord Brahma became aware that the Supreme Lord Krishna has many, many eternal blissful forms of knowledge. He has described such expansions of the Supreme Lord Govinda in his Brahma Samhita 533 as follows. Advaitam achyutam anantam ananta rupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha vede shudurlabham adurlabham atma bhaktau Govindamani purusham tanaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is non-dual and infallible. He is the original cause of all causes, even though he expands in many, many forms. Although he is the oldest personality, he is ever youthful, unaffected by old age. The Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot be known by the academic wisdom of the Vedas. One has to approach the devotee of the Lord to understand him. The only way to understand the Lord as he is by devotional service to the Lord, or by approaching the devotee of the Lord, who always has the Lord in his heart. By devotional perfection, one can understand that the impersonal Brahma-jyoti is only a partial representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, and that the three Purusha expansions in the material creation are his plenary portions. In the spiritual sky of the Brahma-jyoti, there is no change of various kalpas or millenniums, and there are no creative activities in the Vaikuntha worlds. The influence of time is conspicuous by its absence. The rays of the transcendental body of the Lord, the unlimited Brahma Jyoti, are undeterred by the influence of material energy. In the material world also, the initial creator is the Lord himself. He brings about the creation of Brahma, who becomes the subsequent creator, empowered by the Lord. Omangyana timirandasya jananjana shalakaya chakshurundaritanyena tasvashigurave namaha shri chaitanya manovistam stakitanyena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam dutati svapadantikam. Translation. O my Lord, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. In your impersonal Brahman effulgence in the spiritual sky, there is no occasional change and no deterioration of internal potency. I surrender unto you because whereas I am proud of my material body and senses, your lordship is the cause of the cosmic manifestation, and yet you are untouched by matter. So Lord Brahma is offering prayers to Arvadakshaya Vishnu and describing his realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the situation of the conditioned soul in the material world is that the conditioned soul is seeing everything through material senses, even though the soul is actually transcendental to the material domain. And so for this reason, the soul is not able to directly see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because Krishna, the Supreme Person, is transcendental to the material energy. So if your senses are channeled through the material energy, then it's not possible to directly see Krishna. However, you can attain information of Krishna by Krishna's grace, because Krishna is the controller of the material energy. And so if he wants to transmit information into the material world, then he can do that. And If you can directly please Krishna through devotional service, then Krishna may personally, directly reveal himself. So, in this way, it is possible to have some knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Otherwise, it's not possible to do that if one is within the material energy. So, Srila Prabhupada is describing here how the, and the verse is also mentioning, how in the spiritual world there is no passage of time and there is no deterioration, whereas these things are present in the material world. So in the domain of the material energy, you have the three processes of creation, maintenance, and annihilation, which correspond to the three modes of material nature. So the mode of passion corresponds to creation, then the mode of goodness corresponds to maintenance, and the mode of ignorance corresponds to annihilation. So, with these three modes operating under the influence of eternal time, you have a continual process in which the future is not yet manifest. Then, briefly, it becomes manifest and you have the present situation. But then very quickly the present situation passes away and goes irretrievably into the past. So, in the spiritual world, however, this process of creation, annihilation, and destruction does not take place. For example, Srila Prabhupada said here that there are no creative activities in the Vaikuntha worlds. So there everything is eternally present. And this is difficult to understand because we're completely conditioned by this idea of past, present, and future. So, there's some interesting analogies that you can make to illustrate these ideas. And these analogies are becoming more prominent with some recent developments in science. So I thought I'd mention a little bit about that. If you go back to the beginning of modern science, you have the you find that the metaphor of the clock was used to describe the universe. So it seems that in different eras, different material objects become useful as metaphors to enable one to understand everything. And this has a very great role to play in the thinking of scientists. So, back in the early days of modern science, the metaphorical image was that of the clock. So, clocks became very popular in those days. They were the most advanced machines that existed. And people began thinking of the entire universe as a great clock. So, the nature of a clock is that it works with great precision. And once you build it and start it, set it in motion, then if it's a good clock, you just let it go, and it just operates by itself, keeping very accurate time. So this imagery became very popular, and it led to the idea that the universe is like a clock. God built it in the first place, set it in motion, and just let it run. But then God did not continue to have any involvement with the universe. Actually, back in those days, Isaac Newton, who's famous for contributing a lot to the clockwork concept of the universe, argued that God would have to intervene from time to time to adjust the actions of the material elements that were moving according to strict mechanical laws. But the philosopher Leibniz argued that, Newton is saying that God is a bad clockmaker. He's made a clock that he has to constantly adjust. So this is sacrilegious, actually. He's accusing God of poor craftsmanship. So actually, God has created a clock that can run perfectly without any further intervention. So this sounded like a good argument, but unfortunately, it totally eliminated what you could call practical religion. Because practical religion, wherever you find it in human society, involves people praying to God for one thing or another. Either they're praying for material things, or they're praying for freedom from material things, or they may pray for ultimate transcendental understanding or service, but still, they're approaching God for something. But if God has just left the universe to run automatically, then how can you approach God for anything? It becomes a little bit difficult, unless you say that God set it up in the first place, knowing everything that you would approach him for, and in this way, everything was pre-programmed. That would be okay for the materialist who approaches God for material goods, but for the spiritually inclined person, it wouldn't really be too satisfying that you're just approaching the machine that God made in order to get things. So, subsequently, this clockwork universe idea was amended to the next phase, which was what you could call the unintelligent machine. Actually, the clock metaphor was used by a scientist named Richard Dawkins in a book that he called The Blind Watchmaker. So the idea is instead of God who created the clock, now you have a clock that just sort of comes together by itself by a process of evolution. And there's no intelligence behind it. So that's the evolutionary picture of matter in motion. So then the next development that occurred in the 20th century, it seems there were some revolutions in physics, and something called quantum mechanics came up. And this led to introduction of a sort of philosophy of idealism in physics. Unfortunately, quantum mechanics is plagued with some fundamental conceptual problems. At the bottom, it's essentially an incoherent theory. So these ideas never could be explained very clearly. But people basically came around to the idea that somehow or other, everything depends on consciousness and observation. And the world, instead of being made of matter, is in some sense made of ideas, or at least it's idea-like. So this is the development that came up in quantum mechanics. And very large numbers of prominent physicists have presented this kind of idea. Generally speaking, though, the biologists haven't caught up with this. They're still sticking with the old unintelligent machine concept. This concept of idealism is a, in philosophy, idealism is said to be the theory that everything is made of mind or of ideas, and matter simply consists of ideas in the mind. So, in one sense, actually, our philosophy of Krishna consciousness, is similar to idealism, because we're saying actually that the material creation is coming about from Krishna, who is pure spirit, pure consciousness. In fact, we even have the idea that Mahavishnu goes into his yoga nidra sleep, and he basically dreams the universe, or all of the universes. So in that sense, matter does not really exist independently of pure spirit. There's the principle of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, which says that Krishna is simultaneously one and different from his energies. So this is somewhat similar to the concept of idealism, although there are differences there. That concept shows up in an imperfect way in this theory of quantum mechanics. So the next development that occurred in science is the development of the computer. So the computer immediately became a metaphor for the mind. Many different metaphors have been used to explain the mind. Before computers became popular, it was the telephone switchboard. But telephone switchboards are pretty limited. Actually, back in the days of Newton, the mill was a very common metaphor for the mind. Because in those days, mills were very impressive, complicated machines, especially in Holland. where you can still see the windmills. So anyway, the computer became popular, and you have the development of the artificial intelligence movement. So the people in that movement, who could be called the artificial intelligentsia, have the idea that a computer can think if only you can program it properly. It has to be a very powerful computer. You need lots of RAM and many megaflops of instructions. But if you can make the computer powerful enough, it could completely duplicate the human mind. And in that case, it would have a mind. It would be able to think and be conscious just as we're able to do these things. So this is the basic idea of the computer science, well, of the artificial intelligence people. Not everyone in computer science thinks this way. So this goes back to the completely materialistic picture of reality. It says that really there's nothing but matter. And if you can organize matter in the right pattern, then you have consciousness. So the idealistic philosophy, on the other hand, would say that really there's no such thing as matter. Ultimately, there's only consciousness. This is a lot closer to Krishna consciousness. So according to that, then, when consciousness manifests certain patterns, then that constitutes the material world. There tends to be confusion there, though, as to what this consciousness is that manifests the different patterns. There's a concept that's referred to as solipsism, which is that really that nothing exists except my consciousness. Everything is within my consciousness. So actually, the only person who would be entitled to be a solipsist would have to be Krishna, because everything is within the consciousness of Krishna. So the concept of idealism makes sense if you have a supreme consciousness who is generating everything, including the material manifestation. So in recent years, cosmology has also become very popular. There was a time in science where the scientists did not want to talk about the universe and the origin of the universe. They thought that this would be getting a little bit too speculative. However, recently, it seems they've become quite a bit more confident than they used to be. Actually, there was even a time when scientists said we can't talk about the origin of life because that would be too speculative. But they got over that sort of feeling of insecurity. And now they're plunging ahead. So what happens when you apply computer science to the universe as a whole? Well, there are scientists who have done this, and what they do is they come up with the idea of a computer which would have unlimited capacity. This is usually based on some concept of evolution, because the scientists are still very much attracted to evolution. So they say, in the future, as life spreads through the universe and evolves, ultimately, a supreme computer will come about within the universe. Quite a number of scientists have contemplated this kind of idea. For example, one of them is Freeman Dyson, who is a physicist at Princeton University. So his idea is that the universe will gradually cool off, but matter will be organized into a computer which will calculate at slower and slower pace as the universe cools off, but it will be able to keep on going forever. And in this way, it will be able to execute infinitely many instructions. It also will gradually build up an infinite memory capacity. And if it can do that, then it's able to do an infinite amount of calculation and thus simulate the entire universe. So when the universe cools off, this computer can recreate the entire universe through simulation. And since Dyson is thinking from a materialistic platform, he thinks that a material simulation of the universe is as good as the universe. So in this way, everything will be created again. So this is the concept. Recently, another scientist named Tipler wrote an entire book on this, and specifically brought in Christian religion, religious concepts. He identified this recreation of the universe by the computer with the resurrection of the dead as predicted in Christian theology. This is specifically the, you could say, the theory of them bones expressed within a very sophisticated scientific concept context. So in any case, in Tipler's theory, the universe doesn't cool off. Instead, it collapses into what is called the Big Crunch. But while it is crunching together, the universe heats up. And this enables the universe to organize into a computer that runs faster and faster. And it increases its rate in such a way that it can carry out infinitely many instructions before the crunch. So this again gives it infinite capacity, and it's able to recreate the universe, which is the resurrection. So there are all these ideas. Various other physicists have proposed similar ideas. There's a physicist named John Wheeler, and also from Princeton University, who brings in the quantum mechanical idealistic notion, but he brings it in a rather curious way. In his theory, life also spreads throughout the universe. He also has a big crunch in his model. So toward the end of the universe, just before the big crunch, the rate of information transfer accelerates to an incredible degree. But according to him, looking at it from the quantum mechanical perspective, basically there's a sort of confusion there between matter and consciousness. So he sees the transfer of information within this ultimate computer as conscious observations, which in fact bring about the universe. And in fact, they do so in a way that is beyond time. So he postulates a loop in which the observers at the end of the universe, through their observations, bring about the universe, which in turn evolves to become those observers. So this is what John Wheeler is able to come up with. So these are different gropings of the scientists, but they indicate a sort of interesting trend of thought, namely the idea of some kind of ultimate intelligence that has the capacity to create the universe, and which in Wheeler's case has something to do with consciousness, although he's quite confused, really, about how consciousness comes into the picture. Nonetheless, you have scientists these days talking about universal intelligence and universal computers that can create everything. So it's an interesting trend. So Wheeler made the point that he really has to adopt his closed loop theory of causation, because the only alternative would be either an infinite regress in which you say A is caused by B, and B is caused by C, and C is caused by D, and it just goes on forever. Or you would have to have an ultimate mystery in which you say A is caused by B, B is caused by C, and at some point you stop and you say, and then we have a cause which we ultimately cannot understand. It is mysterious. So he said those are the only two alternatives to his approach. But the approach he offers is that A is caused by B, B is caused by C, and C in turn is caused by A. And it goes around in a loop. And this also is a bit of a problem. Somehow in logic, this just isn't allowed. In fact, you can say that you're being logical, but if you introduce a loop like this, actually, you're violating logic. So what is the use of being logical up to that point, and then throwing out logic? So I would suggest that actually the better option is to say you have A caused by B, B caused by C, and at a certain point you do have, in fact, an ultimate cause which you're not going to be able to fully understand. That's the way it is. So according to the Bhagavatam, actually the ultimate cause is Krishna, who's the supreme cause of all causes. So Wheeler, by the way, has an interesting way to put the infinite regress model. He calls this the Tower of Turtles. It seems that once somebody was giving a lecture on the origin of or the nature of the universe, and a lady in the audience spoke up and said, "Sir, actually, the explanation for the universe is that the world is resting on the back of a gigantic turtle." So he replied by very intelligently saying, "Ah, but what is the turtle standing on?" And the lady said, "It's no use, mister. It's turtles all the way down." So this is the Tower of Turtles model. So in any case, you can see some parallels between the gropings of the scientists and the Krishna model, because you have Krishna expanding himself into Mahavishnu and basically manifesting the material energy. He then organizes this material energy to create the body of Brahma, and Brahma then has the potency to create everything else within the material universe. So if a computer is a material organized system that exhibits intelligence, then you could say that the body of Brahma is like that. Of course, the Bhagavad Gita says that the body of a living being is a machine made of maya, yantra ridani mayaya. So this machine concept is there. But of course, there also has to be consciousness in order for this machine to really function intelligently. We see, in fact, in our experience with computers, that computers don't just evolve, but they have to be programmed. Ultimately, there has to be an intelligent programmer behind the computer. So Krishna is the intelligent programmer behind the body of Brahma, and of course the soul of Brahma is also there within that body. And so you have consciousness directing the material machine, and from that the creation of the universe comes about. So in one sense you can say that some ideas in modern science are sort of moving in a very imperfect way in that direction. By the way, this book by this fellow Tipler has become a bestseller in Europe, I'm told, for quite some period of time. And many scientists are lamenting about that. Let's see, in one review of his book, the statement was made that most cosmologists accuse Tipler of the direst crime of perpetrating a hoax on the level of the Piltdown Man. So, anyway, these are some developments in science. Are there any questions? Comments? Yeah?
This is a question from last time that we had it. We wanted to ask you, but you weren't here.
Okay.
It had to do with, what do the scientists think about time?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that relate to the Vedic conception of time?
Well, for the scientist, time actually is quite a mystery. It's actually something relevant to this verse also. The scientists, well, from Newton onward, have time as simply a parameter. It's just like a number. And this is sort of a very imperfect concept, because you imagine the number moving forward along a line, which you could call a timeline. But of course, if the number is moving, then that means you already have time. So you really haven't explained time at all. All you've done is thought of a pointer that is moving, which is sort of like the hand of a clock. That's the way they represent time. So that's the Newtonian concept of absolute time. Then Einstein came along and threw the whole thing into a real state of confusion by introducing a theory of physics in which time and space are interchangeable. And you can map time into space and space into time. So this implied that all of time is laid out, past, present, and future. It's all there, just as space is all there. And Einstein decided he was going to be consistent about this, And he simply accepted that it's all there and that the passage of time is an illusion. In fact, he had a friend named Besso who died at a certain point. And he consoled Besso's widow by telling her that actually the passage of time is an illusion. He said, for the convinced physicist. So everything is there, past, present, and future. Of course, this is interesting because from the Vedic point of view, you can say, it's possible for realized souls to see past, present, and future. So doesn't that tell us that past, present, and future are laid out like a map and that it's just a question of being able to see what is there? And then that leads to the question of, well, what about free will and responsibility? So we can get into lots of different topics. So the other development in physics was that it's observed that certain processes are irreversible. And that's where past, present, and future comes in physics. Because just like imagine a glass of water falling off the edge of a table, a point that was made by fairly recently by a couple of scientists, one of them is named Charles Bennett, and that is that the key to irreversibility is forgetfulness, which is intriguing. If you retain all information in a transformation, then it's reversible. So the laws of physics and their fundamental level, in fact, retain all information during transformations, so they're reversible. But when you go to thermodynamics, a change is made in the equations, actually, so that things get erased. And that's why you have irreversibility. But it's interesting to look at that from the point of view of the material world and the spiritual world. Because, of course, Krishna never loses anything. And there's no passage of time in the spiritual world in which things are lost. So in that sense, you have, so to speak, perfect reversibility. Past, present, and future, the distinctions don't really exist. But in the material world, you have creation, maintenance, and annihilation. And the key thing there is annihilation. So therefore, you have irreversible time in the material world. So that's a parallel that you can draw there. So, yeah?
There's another branch of science, which is psychology, which tries to explain how the subtler realm exists and how it is. And they feel that psychology and real science combined together differently, it's everything that's going. I don't know if you have said that.
Well, psychology contains many different theoretical viewpoints. There's the old viewpoint of behaviorism. There the idea was that we simply refuse to talk about the mind. We just look at the person in terms of stimulus and response. The stimulus goes in, the response comes out, and we're just interested in the correlation between the two. So they didn't want to talk about mind at all. So naturally they could never explain what the mind is, because they've ruled out the very idea of explaining it in the beginning. Then there's what is called functionalism, which is very popular nowadays. According to that model, you regard the mind as a computer. And basically, that's the artificial intelligence approach. The idea is we'll understand the mind by seeing how the brain works as a computer. But they cannot deal with consciousness. Then there are other systems of thought in psychology which are considered to be less scientific, in which they do want to talk about consciousness. And they even bring in generally impersonal philosophy in different forms, from basically different forms of Mayavadi philosophy. So you have a variety of things going on in psychology. Ultimately, Krishna consciousness should be the deepest science of psychology. So, yeah?
I have a question about the idea that passion, about creativity and passion.
Mm-hmm.
So creation is absent in the spiritual world. There's no influence of passion. So is creation what's the relationship between creation and creativity? For example, when Krishna wants to enjoy a particular mood in Vrindavan, Vrinda creates a particular kind of, Vrinda Devi creates a particular kind of mood with the flowers and the creepers and the seas and the wind and this and that. So, is that a transcendental passion? Is that a kind of, so what's the relationship?
Well, there does seem to be some transcendental passion also. As far as I can understand, from a philosophical point of view, the difference there would be that everything, well, you see, ultimately I think you have to go back to the principle of the Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, because in the spiritual world everything is tied together. So when something is created in that sense in the spiritual world, it's also already there in Krishna. In the material world, when something is created, it's also coming from Krishna, but it's manifesting in the realm of matter. So from the point of view of the realm of matter, it's something new. In fact, that's interesting if you go back to this idea in thermodynamics, because what you see in thermodynamics is things that are so tiny that you can't measure them are constantly being magnified so that they have an observable effect. And then they're constantly being reduced down so that even though they're still there, they no longer have an observable effect. So if you are able to see the things that are in unmeasurably small, then you have perfect reversibility. But because of your limit in perception, that you can only see the things that are on a big scale, you have creation where the things are being expanded, and you have annihilation when the things are being contracted to the point of unobservability. So you can make an analogy there to the situation with the spiritual world. From Krishna's point of view, it's all there, and he expands it and manifests it. If your senses are limited so you only see the manifestation, then it seems to be created. And then he unmanifests it when he wishes, and then it seems to be annihilated. But from Krishna's point of view, in the spiritual state in which he sees everything, then it's all there. So that's an analogy. Yeah?
Back more. Just like the elements, I think you said in the class, there's the pure elements in the layers, and also the elements as we see in here, and there's some difference. And we say that the manifestation of Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma in the different modes is kind of like pure modes as opposed to the modes and the reactions we experience here at this level.
Oh, that's an analogy. Obviously, the consciousness of Brahma is exceedingly exalted compared to that of lesser persons within the universe. It is said that he is influenced by the mode of passion, however. For example, there's that story in which Bhrigu Muni was trying to find out who is the real Supreme Personality of Godhead using the experimental method. So he first went and slighted Lord Brahma by not using proper etiquette in approaching him. And Lord Brahma became angry. So this was a manifestation of the mode of passion. Then he proceeded to directly insult Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva was about ready to annihilate him, which was a manifestation of the mode of ignorance. But then he went even further and he assaulted Lord Vishnu. But Lord Vishnu was perfectly forgiving and in no way agitated by any sort of anger. So that story is there. So it would appear that Brahma can be under the influence of passion, but Lord Krishna is very much looking after him. And of course the Brahma in our universe finally attains the level of a pure devotee. That's another aspect. That doesn't have to happen, though, as I understand. You could have a Brahma who's not a pure devotee.
Brahma was a Gambriya, the one of the four Kumaras who used to go out and have kids.
Yeah.
And the negatives of Prashida manifesting himself in
Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.